it's enlisting the drivers in a response to sexual violence. So it's not just stopping particular drivers doing something bad, but it's changing the ethic of the driver community, if you like, so that when they become aware of another driver doing something that he shouldn't be doing, then they will be supported to intervene in that and also help survivors of violence that they come across to get necessary legal services or health services or social support.
How has this project been able to transform people, like the men you work with?
I think it's transformative to feel that you have a role to play in making your community a better place. You know? I mean, I think the boat drivers would be one example. Some of the work in the refugee camps, the Refugee Law Project, it was very inspiring in terms of working with some of the young people, the young refugees in those camps, who are in a situation which is extremely disempowering. And the project has worked with them and supported them to be a part of processes and structures which are helping to improve their community. So in Uganda, the Refugee Law Project supported a youth group in two camps to do some research in the camps about the extent of sexual violence, to take those findings to the gender-based violence committee, which is run by the camp authorities, together with the different NGOs that are providing services to the camps. And as a result of that, some of the young people were invited onto that committee as representatives to be voices of particularly the young people in the camp, speaking out about what their experience is in terms of sexual violence in the camps. And I think that's a very empowering experience.
Did you ever encounter any resistance in the communities that you've worked in?
I think the main resistance that we came across was more from institutional authorities. So in India, the Center for Health and Social Justice was supporting work on college campuses in Varanasi and Pune. And there was some resistance, you know, unsurprisingly, from college authorities in terms of not wanting to acknowledge that sexual harassment particularly was a problem on campus and claiming that anti-sexual harassment committees were in existence and were dealing with the problem when they clearly weren't, based on some of the surveys and interviews that the activists did on those campuses. So there was some resistance to taking the problem seriously and then taking the necessary steps to re-energize those anti-sexual harassment committees. In terms of, you know, men in communities, I think there was a range of reactions, some resistant, some passive, and some very enthusiastic.
For the Mobilizing Men campaign, is this a job that can only be done by men?
No, no. Certainly in Kenya and Uganda, it was men and women. In India, it was more men, and I think there are different reasons for that. I think in some of the places we were working in India, those settings did feel a bit more gender segregated, so it made sense to be focusing on men particularly. We called it Mobilizing Men because we wanted to orient towards men needing to step up and take action together with women. I think women have been fighting the struggle for gender equality for many years now. And part of our impetus about naming men in the title was to say men have a responsibility and an interest in being a part of that struggle as well. But we were keen on men and women, and indeed in India we were working with a transgender group in Kolkata, so people of all gender identities working together to make a change in, you know, to work for gender justice in their communities.